thinking about climate change is not some esoteric future thing. It's just like, I want my kids to have the same chances that I do. And the fact that you're telling me that your short-term profits are more important than our taking care of all the world's children, that's not okay.
Hi, I'm Alana Weston, chairman of Selfridges Group, and welcome back to How to Lead a Sustainable Business, the podcast where I speak to the pioneers who are driving us towards a greener future. Today, I'll be speaking with the acclaimed economist and Harvard Business School professor, Rebecca Henderson. Rebecca is one of the world's most influential and persuasive scholars focused on driving large-scale change. Her latest book, Reimagining Capitalism: How Business Can Save the World, is sure to become a Bible for business leaders. She looks at capitalism through the lens of real business case studies and lays out a pragmatic roadmap for how business can help to catalyze the systemic change we need to build an economic system that works for everyone. To start with, I wanted to get a sense of how this book came to be.
About 15 years ago, I saw Al Gore's movie, An Inconvenient Truth. And I thought, well, you know, I need to do something. And my first thought was to leave academia. I thought, you know, teaching MBAs, well, what has that got to do with anything? I need to become an activist and really try and raise awareness around these issues. And it was my friends who work for NGOs who persuaded me not to do that. They said, you know, no, business has a really important role to play in addressing these issues. And I was fortunate. I was at MIT at the time with a wonderful colleague called John Sturman. And he and I and another friend decided to launch the first business and sustainability course at MIT. So that was the way to sort of think about, like, well, what could the role of business be here and how do we think about this? I was recruited to Harvard about 5 years later by the dean who looked at me and he said, Rebecca, we missed the financial crisis. It's your job to make sure we don't miss the climate crisis. And together with a great colleague called Forrest Reinhardt, started teaching the course Reimagining Capitalism, which I knew I wanted to do something about really what can business do? Because the course I taught at MIT was the sort of classic shared value course. You can make money and do good. But I thought, you know, if every business in the world just started to clean up its own house, how would that really add up to the kind of deep cultural and systemic change, which is what I thought we needed? And so how do we put these pieces together? And I had no idea. I mean, that first class, there were 28 students in the room, and I just put on the syllabus stuff that I wanted to read that I thought might be helpful. The class went really well. Next year, 386 students signed up, which was nearly half the second year MBA class. And I don't think that was me. I think it was that the students then, and indeed right now, really want to talk about these issues. They really want to understand how a business person can be a responsible leader. And the book came about because the students insist I write it. They were like, Rebecca, you have to write this down so I can give it to my friends. So that's why I wrote it down.
It's really fantastic. It captures so much that I've been talking about with my own executives for the last 10 years. And I went to an event last year, actually, where the resolution was to stop climate collapse. We must end capitalism. And there were some great speakers, including Adair Turner and George Monbiot. And they all argued their case brilliantly, both sides. You know, you obviously believe capitalism is here to stay, but needs to be transformed. How do you answer those who believe it's obsolete at best and dangerous or evil at worst?
When I start talking about reimagining capitalism, many groups say to me, why reimagine it? Why not just throw it out? And I've had the great pleasure of talking briefly to George, and I know his books. And I've been on several panels with Kate Raworth, who I really like. And she's like, let's get rid of these 19th century isms. Capitalism, socialism, there's got to be something better out there. So I'm deeply sympathetic to the idea that what we're doing right now is not working at all, or kind of working, but generating enormous side effects and unacceptably large side effects. So the question is, throw it out and start over. And so, you know, I am so incrementalist ameliorist on this. I'm like, do you have any better ideas? I mean, really? Free markets, for all their faults, have this incredible property. They generate innovation and efficiency. And we really need both. Because one way we're going to address the climate crisis is by using everything much, much more efficiently. So we need massive waves of innovation. And I don't really know any mechanism except the competitive market at scale to do that for us. And I think one of the other things we're going to need are lots of well-paying, honorable, exciting, purpose-driven jobs, good jobs. And I don't know where those come from, except from firms that are really trying to do better and grow and thrive. I think the rules of the game need to be completely rewritten so that firms are tightly constrained in what they can do. Decent labor legislation. We need rules that ensure that you can't just throw carbon dioxide into the air or poison the ocean or dump your waste into the river. But I think there's a pathway to building a balanced capitalism that doesn't require us to imagine utopia. And, you know, when some of my students say, you know, no, I think I'd rather go with socialism, you know, sometimes what they mean is a decent healthcare system.
Right.
And I am totally up for a decent healthcare system. And reasonable education and decent childcare benefits. And, you know, what they mean is Finland. But, you know, Finland and Denmark are not socialist countries. They have real competition between world-beating, competitive capitalist companies. And I think one of the geniuses of democratic capitalism, when it really works, when you have a democratically accountable government that's holding the market accountable, when you have the free market that's generating all this amazing energy and stuff, and a strong civil society that's holding the government and the market in balance, one of the geniuses is that it plays to both sides of our nature. We've got the competition and the drive and the me, but we've also got the wait, us and later. And I think for me, building a strong society is always holding those two in tension. So that's what I say by I'm an ameliorist incrementalist. One of my friends said, Rebecca, your book shouldn't be called Reimagining Capitalism. It should be called Back to the Capitalism of the 50s and 60s, only without the misogyny and the racism and with better environmental rules. You know? but I guess that is what I think.
Can I just ask, how do you think about growth? Do you think that there are new definitions that are required and include some more of the externalities that come in, whether that's natural resources or people or, you know, how do you think businesses should be thinking about growth?
So for so long, we measured growth on an income basis, as if we thought the only thing that mattered about our families was our income this year and how much we spent. And we didn't look at anything like the house we were building or the garden we were putting in or the love we were creating amongst each other, right? All that mattered is how much money we spent. Because GDP doesn't take into account any measure of social well-being. So suppose, for example, we have a massive outbreak of depression and that leads to crime and that drives up policing. In the GDP statistics, that looks like a good thing. We just grew because we have all this mental health treatment and we built the prisons and we're paying the police people. And like, is that what we meant? Not really. But GDP doesn't see any difference. And then how do we think about growth when like, oh, I had an amazing year. I fished out every single fish in all the lakes and all the rivers and all the continental shelf that I have control over. And whoa, a banner year. Well, next year's not going to be so great, right? We're not looking at the health of our assets, our natural assets, and technical term would be natural capital. This is a mistake that most firms wouldn't make. They have a balance sheet, income statement, assets. And you know, like, I'm going to have to do maintenance, I'm going to have to replace my factories, but we're running our societies as if our capital was, you know, not there. So we don't maintain our infrastructure, even our physical infrastructure, our roads and our ports, let alone our topsoil, our oceans, our atmosphere. It's so very basic, but this idea that $10 worth of coal-fired electricity, you know, it's roughly enough electricity to power your cell phone for about 10 years. When you burn the coal to make that $10 worth of coal-fired electricity, it causes at least $8 worth of damage to human health, at least $8, because of all the mercury and the lead and the particulates. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people die every year because we burn coal. And another $8 worth of climate damage. So, you know, it's like it's completely invisible. So our measures, you know, the real cost of that $10 worth of coal-fired electricity is more like $26, not 10. I mean, one of my colleagues at Harvard just came out with something he calls impact-weighted accounts. So for 1,800 firms, he and his team have calculated the impact, the environmental impact those firms are having. And he finds that a third of those 1,800 firms, the environmental damage they're causing is greater than their total profits.
Wow.
So I think if we're going to think about growth, we need much better measures.
What characteristics do you think the leaders of the next 10 years are going to have in order to lead this change?
Courage. Driving change in any organization is hard. They need to be great business people. You know, this is not about puppies and flowers and making great speeches. This is about really thinking about how to shift the business model of the firm so that it generates decent returns for investors, creates great jobs, and has some positive effect on the outside world. You know, Professor Colin Meyer, who I assume you know pretty well or have at least heard of at Oxford, his definition of a purpose-driven firm is one that I really, really am liking at the moment, which is firms that exist to solve public problems. I really like that. Mm-hmm. It's like, what is my purpose? My purpose is to solve public problems. And that might be getting decently priced toothpaste to everyone in the world. That's a public problem. But it also highlights it's not about creating problems. Leaders in this space seem to have a sense of the bigger picture, a sense of broader vision, and last but not least, a deep sense of emotional connection and caring. Because yes, we have to have a business case, but at root, this is about building a great life for our employees and us and our children and not toasting the planet.
But what is it that stops CEOs from seeing what's right in front of them? Is it a lack of insight? Is it a lack of imagination? Is it pressure or arrogance or even fear? I mean, what stops us from seeing it?
Oh, I wish I didn't know the answer to this question. First is so-called cognitive blinders or frames. I've learned to see the world in a certain kind of way, and I take that way for granted. I read certain kinds of magazines if I'm old. If I'm younger, I listen to certain kinds of podcasts or follow certain kinds of people on social media. I have a sense of the way the world works, which is often an integral part of my identity. And the idea that the world might be fundamentally shifting. I mean, if I'm a fashion company CEO, and the idea is out there that, wait, fast fashion might be fundamentally flawed from the base up. That's a super hard thought. I mean, it's just a hard thought, right? Hey, I got where I am by being really good at it. And we created a lot of value and we made a lot of consumers very happy and customers love it. And what do you mean? The second problem is well, yes, even if you're right. Okay, I guess this fast fashion thing, I mean, I see how much waste we're generating and I see that consumers are sort of starting to feel uncomfortable with it and the supply chains are a mess. Okay, maybe we need to do something different, but that sounds really expensive. And, you know, I don't have any spare resources. Do you have any spare resources? You don't have any spare resources either. I mean, everybody is running, you know, flat out, and you have this kind of grand idea about a new business model. And I mean, no. And so suppose you solve those two problems. Okay, it is happening. I guess I can see we might make money. And in fact, if we don't move, we'll lose a lot of money. So, okay, I guess I'm up for it. Well, now we've only just begun because now we have a huge organization where everyone is doing their job and they know their job really well. And if we're going to do things differently, somehow I have to kind of move all the pieces. And wait, it gets worse. I have to move all the incentive regimes. There's a problem called overload. Every major organization, not every, 98% of every major organizations I've worked with, if you make a list of every project they have underway and the amount of time it's going to take to get those projects done, and you add that up, it typically adds to about 300% of available capacity.
Mm.
Everyone is running in circles. There's no slack. And you sort of manage it and a lot of stuff doesn't get done, but because we're all in our little jobs and we know what to do, we kind of make the organization work. You try doing something new in an organization like that and balls start dropping all over the place. Things start crashing. So you have to solve the overload problem. And of course, I had a contract for a book called Stuck, which was about this problem, but I was too overloaded to write it. So I never wrote it.
I thought it was very interesting in one of the talks that I watched, you said, you've got to marry purpose with a clarity of strategy. Can you explain how leaders can begin to craft that strategy to deliver on the purpose when often the numbers are not telling them that they need a new strategy and the competition is not telling them they need a new strategy? How do they bring the organization with them and even begin to construct a new plan?
What I found in 20 years of studying innovation is that you start with the end in mind. So you, as a leader, you have a really deep feeling that the firm has to shift, that there's a major problem we need to address. And that can come from all kinds of places, but the sense that this is central to the business and you need to pay attention to it. And now what's your problem? You now have two problems. The first is nobody else has that sense. So how do you begin to persuade the people around you that know this is really something worth thinking about? And so the first step is really building the sense that the world could change.
Mm-hmm.
I use scenario analysis to do this. I know leaders have used site visits to do it. So you send people off to visit the small entrepreneurial firms or the places in the world where the change is happening. And you really try and make it real as you can. Because there has to be some shared sense of the challenge. And once you have a shared sense of the challenge, then the question is, okay, how do we build a business model that works in this space? And that's all about experimentation.
Mm.
It's those three steps. Someone realizes there's an issue, you have to persuade a group of that, and then, okay, you brainstorm, you think, you find the business model. Because I think one of the things we do know is there are, particularly in the case of climate change, billion-dollar business models in dealing with this issue and thinking it through. And if we can get ourselves out of the daily routine, we can go and find them.
My husband's an architect, and I've spent most of my career reimagining what department store could be in a physical and now a digital sense. And so I was quite struck by the idea of architectural innovation that you mentioned in your book and how it differs from disruptive innovation. Could you just explain a little bit what you mean? Because I think it's the key to some of this.
So the pure form of disruptive innovation, as my colleague Clay Christensen described it first, was that customer needs shifted very significantly. And if we have a word that is just for big change, let's call that discontinuous. So his old example was the steel industry, where the big steel players were making the steel more and more efficient and better quality. And then these quick and dirty mini mills came in from underneath and said, no, we can make good enough steel. And, you know, it doesn't have to have all these amazing properties that you care about. It's just good enough to sink in cement. And so they really exploited a very different section of the market. And the whole way we thought about consumers shifted. And that's disruptive innovation. And it's absolutely discontinuous and it creates all kinds of problems. And I know you've seen it in the fashion business, right? Architectural innovation is about the system that's producing the product. So let's hold customer needs steady for a while and focus on the fact that the production technology has really changed or that the supply chains are really shifting. And we really need to reorient how we produce this product. to do that, in many cases, you need to think fundamentally differently about how work is arranged inside the organization. So in a modern car company, you've got people thinking about engines and chassis and bodies. And now suddenly we're going to go to electric vehicles that are self-driving. And that changes like the total physical architecture of the product and the production process completely. My engineering side is coming out. I usually try and keep it under good control. But basically, it's sort of the electric engine becomes not nearly as important as the control systems for the car, which need to be integrated into the design. And we never talked to each other before. And how do we think about that? I mean, the easiest way to think about it is you need a complete organizational change. The harder way to think about it is the mental models that people have in their heads become obsolete. Mm-hmm. It's wholesale structural change in the way we think about the business.
So what makes you hopeful? What makes you hopeful?
Humans are so resourceful, so smart. I was 20 years a professor at MIT. I have no doubt that technologically we can fix the problems we face, that we can arrest the progress of climate change, that we can create good jobs for everyone on the planet. We have the resources, we have the wealth to do it, for sure. We're so rich. If it was more equally divided, we can, give everybody a decent job and a decent living. So I think humans are infinitely resourceful, and that makes me very hopeful. Well, you're going to say, but what about the politics? There's that wonderful E.O. Wilson phrase, the problem with humans is we have Paleolithic emotions, medieval institutions, and godlike technology. But at root, I think we can see where we need to go. And this may sound a little kind of grand, but I think as you look back over the sweep of human history, it's been this fight between our, resources are controlled by a few for the sake of the few, very selfish, very exploitative, very exclusionary. And we've been fighting that for, you pick a number, 300 years, 400 years, trying to build a juster society, a more sustainable society. Because thinking about climate change is not some esoteric future thing. It's just like, I want my kids to have the same chances that I do. I don't want them to have to deal with the floods and the fires and the droughts. I just want to take care of my children. And the fact that you're telling me that your short-term profits are more important than our taking care of all the world's children, that's not okay. And I think this powerful moral intuition that we have to shift is really, really, really there. And last but not least, of course, the students I work with. The fact that they are not satisfied with the status quo, the fact that they are so keen to see things change. I come back to that Tom Toro cartoon, the small group of ragged children sitting in front of the ruins of civilization around a campfire. And a man in a ruined business suit is saying, we did destroy the planet, but along the way we created, for one beautiful moment in time, we created a great deal of shareholder value. We're smarter than that.
Yeah.
We really are smarter than that. So I am hopeful, not optimistic, but I am hopeful.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Rebecca. I really enjoyed speaking to you, and it makes me feel hopeful too.
Oh, Alana, thank you very much. It's really a pleasure. And it's people like you and firms like Selfridges that help make this vision a reality. You're doing the hard work on the ground, the day-to-day work of actually making this happen. So thank you very, very much.
If you were inspired by my conversation with Rebecca, please remember to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts, leave us a review, and share it with anyone you think might find this series valuable. This episode was brought to you by Selfridges Group and Radio Wolfgang. The producer was Eli Block, and the production manager was Katie Fuller. Thank you once again to Rebecca Henderson. I'm Alana Weston, and this is How to Lead a Sustainable Business.